Hey, Pulp fans, thanks for your support. Whether you're subscribing to the podcast through iTunes, visiting pulpmx.com, streaming the show via the Stitcher app on your smartphone, or buying from our show sponsor, btosports.com, without you, we could not do this. You can still type M-A-T-T-H-E-S upon checkout at btosports.com if your order is $100 or more for a discount. Lastly, for some insider info and maybe a laugh or two, follow Mathis's Twitter updates at twitter.com/pulpmx. Water's clear and my ears underwater. Totter and hum from the car.
Disclaimer.
During this episode of the Steve Mathis Show, there is a high
chance ability
you will either learn something
a lot of people don't know,
you left thinking,
duh,
or make you say to yourself,
dude, that's so funny.
The bottom line is,
this podcast serves as archival
documentation
of this interview.
Welcome to the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Trans World Motocross, hosted by Steve Mathis.
Welcome to the BTOsports.com Trans World Motocross podcast show. With me on the line is a guy I've always been wanting to get on one of these shows, and we finally tracked him down after a little while, and that would be former 125 national champion Guy Cooper. Cooper, what's going on, man?
Oh, not a whole lot. Getting older.
Getting older. Hey, thanks for doing this, man. I really appreciate it. You're a guy I've got some more than a few requests from different listeners, and also, too, I've always thought you've been an interesting show. So, it's cool. What's Guy Cooper up to nowadays?
Well, I've got a five-year-old daughter. She turns five next week, actually. And so that's been our life for the last 5 years. It's unbelievable what children will do. It'll turn your life around. And before that, it was all two wheels. Always, all my life's been two wheels. And I still enjoy it. I've got a KTM 300. I do a little bit of the enduro cross. Life has definitely slowed down, though.
Yeah, you've even after you quit racing motocross, you know, you did the GNCCs, you did some enduro stuff, then you made a comeback to the nationals, and yeah, like you said, enduro crosses again. It seemed like everywhere you look, Cooper was still racing.
Yeah, I'm getting closer to that 50 mark, and I've made some promises to a few, Cycle City Promotions. He has, you know, the arena crosses in the central part of the United States.
Uh-huh.
And he made me come out at 40, so he's probably, since I've made some comments, I'll be back when I'm 50. It's getting closer to that point, so you still might see me out there doing a little bit of stuff.
Yeah, how much do you ride moto anymore?
Not a whole lot. I had Trey Kennard come up a few weeks ago or a few months ago. Let me take that back, a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And got to ride with him and went down to my supercross track that hadn't been worked on in years. Yeah. And took the dozer and prepped a few things. And my intention was to prep it so he could still do some jumps, you know, 70-footers and stuff.
Right.
And my neat supercross track has always been in the trees. I don't know if you... Did you ever make it by to see it?
No. I think I've seen it in some videos, though. Yeah.
Yeah, it's in the trees, and it's as big as any supercross, but you don't know it because you're in the trees.
Right.
And every... It was a natural setup that I didn't even know was on the property. It was all overgrown with a bunch of greenbriars, and I'm back with the dozer, one of the winners in about 92 or whatever, and
uh-huh.
Start uncovering this neat land. It was an old creek bed that the creek has changed its route, and so years and years ago.
Right.
And so what it developed was a natural tabletop that's 600 or 700 feet long, and so I just cross it, come back, cross it, and the track is basically built in that over that natural tabletop, and so we call it the tabletop track, and it's relatively safe. It would be extremely safe if you took the trees out of it,
yeah.
But the trees are lined. The track was threaded through the trees, and so sometimes you have to angle to the right or to the left. And once you get it dialed in, I don't even feel the trees are in the way. But I think Robbie Raynard's put a mark pretty high on one of the trees, and there has been some accidents, but
yeah.
For the most part, it's an awesome track set in the trees. And so, back to my point, I was in there a few months ago trying to kind of build some of that stuff up, not without any intention of me jumping them, and get down there and start showing Trey, and I come up to it, and it's like, I know I used to hit it in second, pretty hard to do it, and so I started hitting, and before the day was out, I hit every jump on the Supercross tabletop track. So, yeah, it was fun.
Sky Coupe was back.
There was not very much whip to it, though. I still have that, I used to be so comfortable whipping the thing flat, letting it make its full transition, and then land it, and now... back then it was the big thing is you've got to be patient with it. If you're going to do a big, get it turned around backwards and flat, you've got to do the whole thing without getting nervous.
Yeah.
And about the time the thing gets pretty flat, I will get tense and try to straighten it up. And I haven't had any big get-offs in the last year or two, but I've had some close calls because I'm not fluid with it. I'm not letting it do its course.
Well, also, too, four strokes, if you're riding a four stroke, they're not as easy to get back.
No.
Yeah.
Whenever I got on that Husaberg in 97, that video crew came down. This was back when they first started doing all the big crusties and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried a big 90-foot completely flat whip on a Husaberg and came up short and sideways, and it was not pretty.
Yeah.
It looked like a car wreck. It blew the radiator through. It's one solid big radiator,
right.
Blew it out the side of the frame. It looked terrible.
I can guarantee you that's the furthest a Husaberg has ever jumped.
Actually, I went to the sand dunes with a paddle. It's a 6-speed paddle tire, 501 Husaberg, and Kenny Bartram was there on a Suzuki without a paddle, and we found this tabletop was about 150 feet, and he could just barely make it. Well, that Husaberg, there was no problem making 150, and so I started diagonaling it more and more and more, and pretty soon I would go down the sand dune in sixth and have to downshift at the base in fifth and hold it wide open and just sail off of it. And Kenny stepped it off. Of course, that's just stepping it off, but it was 210 feet by Kenny's guesstimate,
right.
And it was huge.
on a Husaberg, you deserve extra medals for that. For the Husaberg. obviously, the last time, or the first time I called you to do one of these, Trey Kennard was in the process of getting some wins and building some momentum and hoping to catch Porcel. Well, we all know what happened now. Here we are doing it in November. You had to be pumped on that. Now, Trey's, you're one of Trey's heroes, and I know you, like you said, you interact with him quite a bit, so that was cool.
Yeah, we Wanda and I, when I say we, it's Wanda and I saw him grow up from 50s at Cooperland in 97, and look where he's at today. It's awesome.
Right.
And he's a good kid. We like to see the good clean cut, good image, he hasn't had it given to him his whole life, with the tragic accident with his dad. That's just that much more gratifying to say, look what he's done. So it's super.
Yeah, absolutely. And how much do you follow the Supercross series and Nationals nowadays?
Oh, I've got everything TiVo'd.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah,
oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
I keep up with it. And from a previous champion, you get to send in the paperwork, and so I've got passes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, last year, early in the year, we had planned it out to where I could hit three of them, and ended up, things came up, family, whatever,
right.
And ended up not going to a single Supercross last year. So
right.
Definitely need to work that into my plans to go watch some.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like you're one of those guys that retired from the limelight, and you never, you had no problem letting it go. You know what I mean? Like, you didn't need to be around the scene, and you weren't necessarily working, trying to get a team manager job or trying to do this or that. Were you at peace when you retired? You were totally happy?
No, it's something that's hard to let go. You still have, I mean, you make competition. I'd make a competition with Wanda over stupid little things, and she'd look at me like, really?
Right.
And I'd go, yeah, but I still got the, you know, I've got the drive to go after something. So,
right.
Yeah, it seems like you do. It doesn't matter if it's yard work. When that's the goal, to go out there and finish it up, mm-hmm. you know, it's almost like a race for me out there working it. So,
right.
It was a little bit hard to truly slow down, but there's been a lot of time since,
yeah.
you know, the,
94?
In the peak of my career.
94.
And so I can comfortably say I've slowed down and, it doesn't bother me that I don't have to be at the races to go race or
yeah.
be that involved. Although I still love it. It's been my passion. It always will be my passion. And one of the things that concerned me a few years ago, we had a few locals that they were fast. You know, you've got Johnny Marley, which is like a Ron Lachine. You know, he's very gifted and
yes.
extremely fast, but a few things take his mind away from being out there in the racing. And but whenever I'd show up to a race, whenever I was 40, 41, whatever, I had a target on my back because you had these kids that they were every bit as gifted as I was or naturally talented as I was to go race, but I still had the experience and you know a little bit of know-how to sometimes still beat them.
Right.
And so yeah, we Johnny and I one of my last big hurrahs was you know a local race where I probably went way over my head to run the race. And do you have a minute? I'll tell you that
yeah.
story. It's pretty
yeah.
funny.
We got another 5 minutes. Yeah.
You know, Johnny is very talented and he's fast and he's in better shape than I am. He even then he should have been in quite a bit better shape than I was. But I got the start and he's working through traffic to catch up to me. And this was the winter series. It started the Oklahoma State series, but it was in the winter, and the ground was frozen in some areas, so it's treacherous, big potholes and things. And he's working up to me, and I'm tired by the time. There's only a few laps left,
yeah.
and so I'm not going to pull over for him. I want him to set me up and make a pass, and everything will be fine. And he's working, getting around me, and makes a good dive underneath me without hitting me. I'm up high and he passes me and now he's in the lead.
Right.
And I don't ever give up, so I'm not going to give up going to the next corner, but I'm also not going to go take him out. He's made his good pass and everything. Well, he is so worried that I'm going to come back underneath him that he's rubbernecking and looking all around, and it lets me stay with him. You know,
right.
every corner he's all worried about where everything's at. So for the next lap, we're neck and neck, but he has more speed than I do. He's just worried in every corner that I'm going to try to take some, you know, underneath line.
Yeah.
Well, there was early in the race, there's this downhill and it's frozen because the sun hadn't hit it. And at the bottom, there's two lines. There's that way outside line and it cuts across and then you climb back up, kind of like a Unadilla Screw U, but a smaller version of that. And the other line was to go down the inside, blow past the turn all the way outside and make U-turn and come back up.
Right.
Well, I had been taking the all the way down to the outside, making the U-turn and taking that big 540 KTM smoking back up the hill, and he had his 250 on the inside coming back up the hill. And so we were close in the first part of the race on that area, and now he reverses and he's changing up trying to figure things out. And I'm flying down the inside, and you know, he needs to get stopped a lot sooner than I do,
mm-hmm.
and I realize that he's going to go in front of me, and then we're going to make the turn and back up. Well, he makes the big mistake of making the inside turn and stopping to look at where I'm at. I am beelining down the inside, and he stops in my line, and I hit him so hard. I've never center punched a guy that hard. I took him clean off the track,
yeah.
and you know, he's running to catch the bike and everything, so I know he's all right. And I come back up, I come into the pits, and I go, you guys, he's going to come over, he's going to
yeah.
bring his whole entourage, he is going to be fired up.
Right.
And he never showed up. The 125 class was afterwards, and he comes over there, his head's kind of bowed, looking over there, and somebody goes over there and says, "Hey, Coops, you know, said something about that he hits you pretty hard." And he goes, "Yeah, I've got to respect my elders." And so it was, you know, it was, I didn't intentionally hit him.
Yeah.
It was, he was so worried about the, you know, the crafty line or whatever it may be. But we got to talking quite a bit later that, you know, when I was always a guy that I, some people said I rode, you know, 8 feet wide whenever they were trying to pass me, but I never rubbernecked, and I knew I could tell where people were out, but you're not, I'm not zigzagging the track.
Right.
I was difficult to pass, but once you passed me and you were faster than me, it wasn't, I wasn't going to do a retaliation and take them out.
Yeah.
And so, with people knowing that, it seems like all the older guys all knew that, you know, you're kind of in the, racing circuit and you kind of know. It was always the young kids that, you know, tried a little cheap move and then, they're sitting there in the way afterwards, especially if they were late in the race and that's all they had. They did their last one breath to,
yeah.
to get around you, and then all of a sudden they're in the way. And, you know, the vet guys were even – I've always been considered the vet rider. You know, even whenever I was in my prime, I was 28, 29 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so, some people would say I was an aggressive rider, but –
yeah, there was definitely a few magazine polls, toughest guy to pass, and you know, you'd be up there with Jim Hawley. So
yeah, Jim Hawley and I just saw him the other day. He was, he was one of my toughest guys to pass.
Yeah.
In fact, I took the blunt end of that for a lot of years. He was a lot bigger rider. I was a small, scrawny rider whenever I first started the Nationals, and he took me out plenty of times. But there was a Supercross that I was on him, and I thought he was going to do the big double. And so right behind him, I hit the jump to do the double.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't doing the double, so he's underneath me. I held. I did the Cooper Rev beyond what normally the Cooper Rev was,
yeah.
wide open. And he could hear me above him. And when he got his wheels on the ground, he just did a right turn. And I landed next to him. And but that was my pass. I got around him.
Right.
And so from that day on, any time I came up behind him, I'd hit the jump as high as I could. Even if I knew he was going to double it, I'd jump as high as I could, hold the thing wide open, and he'd just exit, and I could go around him.
Yeah, yeah.
So I found a way that I didn't have to have the controversy of the tangle, because when we got together, he was a lot bigger rider, and I was always hitting the ground.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was definitely – I think he shared some stories with me about that.
Ross Pedersen was another rollerball.
Yeah.
I never got back on him. He seemed to always get the upper hand whenever we raced together.
Well, I hate to tell you this, but he's my childhood hero, so I'm glad.
I like him. He was a great guy. We have no I have a lot of respect for him.
They call him Rollerball for a reason. I know.
Yep. Yeah.
Hey, let's jump in the time machine a little bit here and start your career talking a little bit about that. I first remember you as a kid reading the magazines. You were 1985. They did a story on you. You were traveling with your then girlfriend around, and I believe in a station wagon or something, doing the 125 Nationals. And also it was weird because, you know, you weren't from Southern California, and back then it was odd to see guys from other parts of the country doing well. How much was a struggle was it your early years of doing the Nationals?
That's a two-part question.
Yeah.
One, my brother raced the Nationals,
mm-hmm.
and so I watched from the sideline, from the fence. And, you know, he had national number 44, national 60, and 89. So three top 100 numbers. Never got any recognition out of Oklahoma. Real calm rider, kind of like a Damon Huffman, real smooth. Didn't look fast. And so when he had a top 10 finish, a lot of times they didn't even know he finished top 10 other than results. And I always was mad. I wanted to see him. If he's up there doing good, I want people to see him. And
right.
so... I kind of had that, if I'm ever at the Nationals, they're going to know I'm out there. So I kind of had feet flying.
Right.
Damon Bradshaw, but that, you know, I was before him, but I kind of had that style. I rode on that verge of at any point I could be fallen, and I got comfortable riding at that looks real sloppy, elbows low, constantly panic revving it and that type of thing. But I could ride 30 minutes that way and a lot of times not fall, and you'd swear there was 20 times in there that I should have hit the ground.
Yeah.
And so you get noticed. You know, I can finish eighth or ninth, and you get a little clip in the magazine or whatever. So that helped me, being from Oklahoma. So that this is now going into the second part of that question. Being from Oklahoma, it was hard to land sponsors. So you had to be out there, you had to be seen, and you had to be a salesman. So you're out there doing the best thing you can. You're being as nice as you can. Somebody asks you something, you pump up the product, and you know you're doing everything you can in every angle to make it a true living. And because it's what I wanted to do.
Right. Were you living in Oklahoma?
I was born and raised in Stillwater, Oklahoma, and this has been my home always.
Yeah.
I went from my parents' house to a little house that I bought in 87 to the house I'm in now. So I've moved twice.
You could always ride then. You'd be in California maybe for a month or so, but you'd always,
yeah,
you could always ride.
I would have made more money. I probably would have landed better deals. You know, and looking in hindsight, it probably would have been financially beneficial to be in California. I probably should have done it. A lot of managers, which I had none, but managers would have told me that would have been a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you get those days in Oklahoma where we get the perfect amount of rain. There's no better traction and no better dirt than right here in Stillwater. I mean, people from all over the world have come out here and ride, and if it's that, there's about 20 days out of the year that there is absolutely no better place to ride in the world.
Right, right. Yeah, I imagine, too, you know, if you spend some time out in California riding it with all the other factory guys, people notice you more. But, you know, you were in Oklahoma pounding laps out, right? So.
Yep.
87, you really started to catch fire. You started to win nationals that season. I think in 86, did you win one in 86?
I won a moto in 86, my first moto, and then a double moto win at Troy, Ohio in 87.
Yeah, and you started getting noticed. Now, were you ever actually a full member of Factory Honda, or was it always one of those support guys?
I was always support.
Yeah.
For 1989 and 88 and 89,
yeah.
I had the same factory postcard and autograph stock as Rick Johnson or George Holland, but... Mm-hmm. Never was considered true factory. In 88, going into 89, I just about signed a Yamaha contract. In fact, I had the contract sitting in front of me. It was about $20,000 more than Honda, and I told Yamaha, yes, I'm signing it. I told Honda that it's been a good ride with Honda, but, you know, I'm a privateer.
Right.
This is a full factory ride, and I'm going Yamaha, and everything was fine. Hung up the phone, and about 5 minutes later, Roger DeCosta called from Belgium and said, "Oh, I want to keep you on Honda, and I promise you'll have as good a motor as George Holland. If you don't like your motor, I'll take his motor out for you." You know, some promises, but it was. You know, it made me feel good that they wanted to keep me on Honda,
right.
And I said that mainly it's the money thing, and so they said, give me 5 minutes, and Dave Arnold called back and said, we'll match Yamaha. Although it really wasn't a match, but it was 20,000 more, and Yamaha was 23,000 full factory, and this was still support.
Right. Right.
But I didn't know it was still a support. I was in the understanding that it was going to be factory parts, you know, like a full factory ride. And so I fly out to California 3 weeks before Anaheim, and there's RC Honda crates with George Holland and Rick Johnson, Jeff Stanton, and there's none of mine. And I'm looking around, and Dave goes, "Oh, no, you get the works parts, but weeks after, you know, they send us extra parts, so we'll build your bikes up." So that was a little bit of a bummer.
Yeah, really. You know, in 88, you started winning nationals, so in 88, Holland was riding factory team, and if you hadn't broken your leg in 87, fall of 87.
You do remember the back stuff, yeah.
Oh,
had I not broken my leg in Belgium in the December of 87, things could have been changed a lot more.
Yeah, how'd you do that?
Yeah, Belgium was a turning point. I beat Eric Gabors in my semi. I beat George Jobe in the quarterfinal. Or semi, how they did that, you know, the three times before you get to the main. And then I led the main, won by a couple of seconds, which was, on hindsight, it would have been better if it was a real tight race, but because I had a couple of seconds lead, I wanted to do a big famous whip, yep. So I went way to the right and seat bounced off the finish line. Well, as I was going up the finish line, I see that it's super steep on the right. No one had ridden on that side of the track.
Yeah.
And so at the last minute, I go, I'm just going to jump straight and do a big one-hander and wave to the crowd. But I know I'm going to be a mile high.
Yeah.
So when I hit that, it just popped me straight up. Well, I'm waving my hand to everybody, and my hand went over the finish line banner, which was 22 feet in the air, 7 meters up. And it pulled me off the bike. I had one hand on the throttle grip.
Oh.
And I'd pull the bike back to me, and the foot pegs were, you know, I could just paddle my feet, and it wasn't coming close to the bike. So
yeah.
I checked it a few times trying to pull the bike back and let the bike go at the last minute. But it compound fractured both bones in the bottom right leg. So that was the end of my...
Supercross in 88.
Yeah, end of Supercross for 88 in America, end of the last couple of good races that I could make over in Europe. And so financially it was a big hit, and then also not being able to run the national or the Supercrosses, I became lower on the totem pole.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big helps was Eric Krippa, who's still at Honda now. Eric Krippa still believed in me, and he would take the factory stuff and measure it and copy it, or take something that had been a takeoff of George Holland's practice bike and kind of tinker with it and send it to me and say, bolt this on and tell me what to do. Because he knew I could mechanic on my bike, and he'd send me the stuff. And I got to run. I missed the first two, but I got to ride the last 10 nationals. And in 88, I got 4 first, 4 seconds, and 2/3. And so pretty good results for just 10 races for the year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Now it's time to pay some bills.
Thanks for listening to the BTOsports.com podcast show. Please don't forget that BTO is the world leader in aftermarket motocross parts for the bike or body. You'll find deals like a Shoei VFXW helmet for $309.99, 45% off, or Smith Piston goggles for $32.99, 65% off. Your order can be shipped anywhere in the USA for free, or if you're not in the USA, we ship worldwide. Check it out at btosports.com.
Well, and also, too, you know, Honda's looking at you going, wow, Holland, you know, he doesn't even have as good a bike as George Holland, and here he is whooping ass.
It was 88 was good for me. It didn't turn into the full factory ride in 89, but I kind of liked that Honda made, you know, wanted to keep me and that type of thing. But 89's big turnaround was when the Frenchman Jean-Michel Bayle was going to sign. Honda gave me a heads up saying if Jean-Michel Bayle signs, we're taking all of our support money at the time. I think it was Larry Brooks and maybe Mike Fisher and myself.
Larry Ward, 89, was on there.
That's right, yep. And so a lot of these riders were going to be out of a job if Jean-Michel signs. And I was just kind of naive, hoping that he'd sign with something else and I'd stay with Honda. And it was a last-minute sign, and so called around and kind of had burned that bridge with Yamaha because I told him I'd sign with him and didn't, so that wasn't a place to go to. And Team Green had their plate was full, and so it left Suzuki, and they made an offer to me. They made an offer to Jean-Michel Bayle for $250,000, which he declined, and they offered $50,000 for me, but it was a full factory ride.
Yeah.
And so I took the ride without ever riding a Suzuki. I signed the papers and went down to, I think it was Chuck Cantwell's Oklahoma Honda in Oklahoma City and rode a 125 and 250. And I hated the 125, loved the 250. And the turnaround was I won the 125 championship and could never get the 250 to do what I wanted it to in the Supercross.
Yeah. How funny is that, huh? In 89, what was it like being around the Honda guys, you know, at RJ and Stanton? And although you were a support guy, I've got that year on tape somewhere, and you were up front a lot that season.
I got along with everyone. I got along with every rider. I was more of a privateer than I was a factory rider.
Well, there's one guy you didn't
And even
with.
In the even whenever I was Suzuki factory, the privateers and I seemed to hang out and have a closer bond. But out of the factory riders, Jeff Stanton and George Holland, they were great. I got along good with them. But I never clicked with Ricky. You know, he was Southern California, and we just never got along. And maybe part of that was Brian Lunis. You know, I thought he was an ass, you know. I've got a lot of stories I could tell you all night long about just things that, you know, digs. One I will tell because that kind of explains how the whole year went. You know, I told you about whenever I got to Anaheim, two or three weeks before the first Anaheim Supercross, and I now get to find out that I have hand-me-down works parts.
Right.
And so, you know, I've got to really get on the ball and get this thing dialed in. I only have, I think it was just at 3 weeks before Anaheim. And so I get a 250 that I like. Everything is set up good. Friday night, after practice at press day, Brian Lunis, whenever I come in out of practice, and I was riding good, you know, I was on my game, I was doing good. Brian Lunis looked at my forks and said, "I'm taking those," and just walked right on by. And I turned to Eric and, you know, some of the guys, and they say, "Hey, Rick's not happy with his 89 work stuff, so he needs the 88 factory stuff back so he has, you know, so he can race tomorrow." And Shoah comes to me and says, "Hey, I think I figured out what why they're not liking it. I'll have you 89 works forks tomorrow morning." This is the day of the race. You know, I get a practice on what I'm going to go race. Whether I like it or not, there's not time to change. That was the twin chamber forks.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Brian Lunis made a big to-do about that he's taking my forks. Well, the next day, I ride the 89 forks. They aren't as good, but they're totally acceptable. They're better than production forks by far.
Right.
And I ended up third. You know, I led it for a while. Everything was good. But the dig was Brian Lunis has to tell me, "You see your forks?" And I was like going, "No." And he goes, "Well, they're not here. They're back up to back up to back up," and just winked and walked off.
No, that was like.
You know, you don't need to tell me that. You know, I don't need to dislike you any more than I already do, but
right.
That's just the way he always, you know, kind of came across.
Yeah.
And so.
Funny about Lunis, like, I don't know him at all, but I did a podcast with Damon Huffman, who has nothing really good to say about Brian. And then also Kudrowski. He was brought Kudrowski's mechanic for a while, too, and Kudrowski wasn't at all that pumped on the guy either. So funny how that works out. But
well, him and Rick seemed to click pretty good,
mm-hmm.
but it was all about Rick, you know. And
yeah,
I think
yeah.
that Brian Lunis had other riders who didn't win as much as Rick, so he was constantly furious, you know. I mean, he'd
right.
be throwing and breaking boards. And,
well, we all know what happened in 92, yeah, with Damon. So 89, 125 Nationals, Bradshaw, Kudrowski just a little bit better than you all year. Is that kind of how you remember it?
Yeah, you know, 89 was an emotional bad year for me. My ex-wife, you know, the only national I won,
mm-hmm.
she asked for a divorce the night before the national. And, you know, I cried all night long, had no sleep at all.
Wow.
And,
wow.
you know,
couldn't wait till Sunday night.
That was one of the few times that Rick Johnson actually kind of, you know, saw that I was, you know, just a basket case. And, you know, we talked a little bit before the races, and I went out and got the overall, my only overall of 89. And here's a funny thing, that the ex wanted to ride around with the checkered flag on back of me, and I let her, you know. And Rick goes, "Man, I'd have clutched it and just dumped her right off the back." But, you know, that's life was kind of tough on me in 89
yeah.
As far as, you know, understanding that, you know, we got married. I was 21. She was 18. You know, just out of high school, and you know, we cared about each other, but we grew apart. And she was a fantastic businesswoman. She cracked the whip on me, and you know, we put a lot of money in the bank, and we learned how to live on a low budget. So when we got a divorce, she got a nice settlement, and you know, I had money in the bank. So. Looking back on it, maybe it was a good thing that I had the blinders on so tight, and you know, made me a good racer and kept me focused.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. Yeah, I mean, you got to turn every negative into a positive, huh?
I just wonder. And, you know, her and Cliff, they've got kids, and I'm happy for them, and, you know, they don't live too far from me. I don't ever see them, but I get along with Jaina's father great. You know, my ex-father-in-law was a super good guy, and so I see him every now and then. And actually, my trophy room, I just got my 89 250 back, which was in his shed for the longest time, and all the stickers were still on it. So when I cleaned it up, it was just like 1989 reviewed, perfect. It was awesome.
Does it have the work stuff on it?
It had some work stuff, but remember in 89 at the Supercross, especially because I still had just little bits of stuff, and so they wouldn't let me keep the works forks and stuff. So there's not a lot on the 89.
You know, you talk about 89 for yourself as being, you know, emotionally not that good and not having a work spike and this and that. You got third in the Supercross series and third in the Nationals. I think a lot of riders would love to do that.
I was second going into the last round in the Supercross. I had a 14-point lead over Ron Lachine and was still nervous that, you know, Ronnie could win one.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I was telling myself, I've got to be in the top six to secure second place.
Right.
And I don't know if you were there in 89 at the last round, but I tried quadding this jump and ended up breaking my collarbone. So it should have been a second overall in 1989.
Yeah. Yeah, funny that you say that it was kind of a, you know, a mess of a year or whatever, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
What was it like? Did you get along with Lachine, Ward, all those guys? Everybody?
Yeah, I really got along with everybody.
Yeah.
I don't know, Kudrowski and I didn't seem to get along that well, but he didn't want to like anybody. He'd say it straight up, you know, if I don't like somebody, it's easier for me to beat them. And so, you know, that's just one guy that you didn't really talk too much, but he wasn't wanting to be social either. So
he was pretty quiet, yeah, pretty quiet.
I got along with everybody. We could meet at a restaurant afterwards and joke and laugh. And, you know, Jeff Stanton, if you go back and look at some of the files at Supercrosses, you know, he's going for championship, and I'm going for fourth or fifth in the standings. So he has a lot to lose, and I don't have anything to lose. And there was a couple times we got together, and I know I've knocked him down a few times, and even that night, or the next day, he wasn't mad at me. He knows it's racing, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I never intentionally took him out. I intentionally took out Damon Bradshaw, but the story is not that I took him out from a get-go. It was, if you go back to, I don't know if it was 91 or 92, the two-nighter place,
Pontiac,
Michigan.
Yep.
They had the end of the lap hooked back onto the start with a bowl turn, mm-hmm. or you could go out on the inside and hit no berm and drift real wide. Well, the fastest way to do it was to hit the bowl turn and shoot back up the start line. I mean, obviously, it's a second savings, but if you wanted to pass somebody, you could dive down on the inside and take their line away.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm running second. Bradshaw's coming through the pack. I mean, he's faster than everybody. When he was on it, he was, you know, he was a Bubba. He was completely on top of his game. The sad thing about Damon was he needed to have a little more smarts with him, because when he was going to pass somebody, it didn't bother him to take him out. And in this situation, I'm an old guy. You don't want to take an old guy out, because they think about things and they know where they're at. So I'm going around the bowl turn, going to hook onto the start line, and as I'm going into the bowl turn, I hear Yamaha to the left of me, wide open. There's no braking at all. And as I turn my head to see that he's about to take my front tire out, well, best case scenario, I could have slammed on the front brake, and he just barely clipped my front wheel, and maybe I could keep it, you know, on. Well, I'm not good at hitting the brakes, but I'm better at giving it gas, so I gassed it to where whenever now he came into the side of me, he's coming in completely wheels to wheels with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I let go of the bike and just grab him, and we both hit the ground and bikes flip out, and you know, he loses 7 or 8 points, and which was championship time. For me, I lose $700 or $800 because of my finish goes from second or third to fifth or sixth.
Right.
And so I'm bummed. I want that bonus money, and I want the better paycheck. But for him, all he had to do was wait and set me up and pass me, because I wasn't a retaliation person to come back in the next line and take him out. But you can't take me out just by coming through there, and I don't like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I got along good with Mike Craig, but Mike Craig, when he was 17 and on his way to maybe winning his first Supercross in San Diego, there's a double line left-hand turn, and he goes flying down on the inside, and instead of taking and holding his line, which he had to pass, he hits the line and bounces up and over and just goes to take me out. Well, as he does, I could have run off the track all by myself and crashed, or I could lay my, you know, just keep the pressure on and it'll drag him down. So it ended up dragging both of us down to the ground. But you do that enough times, enough of the young guys come up, go, don't mess with Coop. If you go to take him out, you better make it a good takeout or set him up and pass him and you'll be all right.
Right, right. And, well, actually, one of the questions I have down here is Stanton has told me, before, you know, you gave up your gate to him at the L.A. Coliseum in 92. And a bunch of guys told Stanton, hey, we're here for you over Damon, because Damon had been running roughshod through, you know, through the pack that year. And true story?
Yeah, I don't remember giving my gate spot up, but another guy talked to me the other day, and evidently I did, which it wouldn't have, you know, I would have. It was one of those things where I wanted to see Jeff Stanton win the championship. Damon Bradshaw, I mean, the Golden Boy, actually, it's not the Golden Boy, that's Brock Glover. The Beast from the East. Okay.
Yeah. Golden Boy at the time, the Golden Boy of the sport.
That's true. But no, I didn't like his redneck attitude. I didn't like, you know, when he'd get on the podium and say second sucks and spits on the ground. And I didn't like that. I didn't think it was good for the sport.
Right.
I had figured that he's young in the sport. He's going to have to pay his dues and, you know, he'll win plenty of championships and plenty of races. I mean, he definitely clearly, you know, he won at Osaka when he was 16. He, you know, he won a lot of races. And the future was bright for him to win a lot of races. And so, you know, Jeff Stanton needed a few points, and I said that, Jeff, if you get the whole shot and I'm behind you, you can bet that Damon will not pass me. And that I did say, but I also wasn't going out to take him out. It was just going to be awfully hard for him to pass me. And the funny thing is, he really never put a wheel on me. He rode horrible. Out of all the people, two of the best riders in the world under pressure was Jeff Emig and Damon Bradshaw for under the pressure to still pull it out and win races. But this one overwhelmed him. It was too much pressure. And, you know, there's rumors now that Yamaha, you know, rented a big motor home and set him in there to try to take some of the stuff away. And maybe they took him in to a different surrounding that let him think too much, you know.
Right.
I think he lived the press. You know, you'd go to a international race where you had all the, you know, because Damon, his first few years, as I remember it, I'm pretty popular in Europe because I jumped real high and people would know that, you know, I could fall at any time. When Bradshaw came over, he's unproven, but all the promoters that were hiring him, they knew that he was going to do good.
Right.
And so you had press in his face. You know, here he is just getting off the plane, and there's all this media around him saying, you know, well, you don't know who you're up against. This is the world champion and stuff, and Damon could care less. The more they told him he couldn't do it, the more he was going to prove that he could. And I think the tables turned whenever Yamaha spent all this money and they said, we're giving you all the money you ever wanted, but you're expected to win. And I think that you're expected to win instead of you can't do it was what really jacked with him.
Yeah, well, maybe so. Interesting. Yeah, I've done one of these with him, and he's pretty honest and open about everything. He's a good guy to talk to. As far as it goes, he doesn't put the blame on anybody but himself. And I think you nailed it. I think you nailed it there. So in 1990, you go to Suzuki. You get 10th in the Supercross points. So what was that year like in Supercross?
Well, I went to Europe trying to get my bike to run just like my Honda. Believe it or not, in the Supercross in the U.S., I would run my 250 with stock gearing and could run every jump in first gear. You know, I revved it to the moon. I used an FMF rev pipe. The thing would rev and keep revving and keep revving. And it wasn't that you needed to run the motor out. You needed it to be torquey and traction to the ground. And the way that 250 motor was real smooth, I could seat bounce a 70-foot triple in first gear. And Tom Carson and Fred Andrews both said that there's no way I'm doing this jump in first gear. And I go, you come out and watch me. And it was pretty funny. I proved to them that I could do a 70-foot triple in first. But so I'm trying to get my Suzuki to run that way. And Suzuki's, they had a lot lighter crank, and the motor was just completely different design. And it wanted to lug more. It didn't want to have that just linear power that would rev and rev and rev. And I could not get it to where I could run. You know, I tried running a 16-tooth counter, something stupid, so I could keep running first gear. And so I really fought it in Europe, had did terrible success over there in 1990, and then came back here and kind of fought that whole thing. But I needed that rev limit so I couldn't just over jump something by a mile. I was lightweight, and if I had LaRocco's 250 motor in it and he's jumping a 64 foot triple in third gear, heck, if I hit the thing in third gear the way I left it pinned all the way off the jump, I'd be jumping 90 100 feet out. And so it really, really was tough for me to get that thing dialed in. But once I got the bike to where we geared it back down, I started running second gear. We had closer gear ratios, so it wasn't such a big spread when I had to shift gears. That helped me a lot. I started running second. And it seemed like every time I'd have a good thing going, I'd screw it up. You know, I had too much will of wanting to get up there and prove that I could still get that Suzuki on top.
Let's remember, too, there was a big gap between a Honda and everybody else back then.
There was. You know, I mean, Hannah would fly back from Japan and just talk so much about the new prototype Suzuki that's coming out the next year. And he started testing that thing in 91, and it was supposed to be a 93 bike. It didn't come out in 93, didn't come out in 94. The rumors had it that we heard that American Suzuki didn't want to spend the retooling because it's like $1 million to retool and do all the different stuff. And so they postponed it all the way till we know what the bike was, 96. That bike was tested by Bob Hanna in 91.
Oh, jeez.
And so, they were way behind the eight ball. Mm-hmm. A bummer because I went from my parents selling Honda and Kawasaki's and a yellow bike was the yellow plague. You know, my dad made jokes as I was a kid growing up. So when I got my Suzuki ride, all my family rode Hondas. And it took me about the end of my Suzuki career to turn them all yellow. Everyone, my garage, I had 30 Suzukis. Every time Suzuki would hem-haw about trying to pay me or do something, I would trade it out for a bike. So I seriously had about 35 Suzukis in my garage. And everyone I knew rode Suzukis, and it's a bummer because I really wish that 96 bike would have been out in 93. I probably would still be racing Supercross.
Yeah, really, huh? Although you did meet, 1990 was the first year that you met one of your lifelong friends, Marshall Plum, who Canadian guy, used to work for Rollerball Peterson, now has a shop in Oklahoma, and by all accounts, you and him are still friends and still talk every now and then.
Yeah, he bought the house my first house that I bought. He lives in that, and the shop building that I opened, a little trials motorcycle shop and a repair shop, he now rents that out and has Marshall's suspension. We see each other on a regular basis.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's good. Good. So 1990, Nationals roll around. You already went on the record earlier in this show saying you love the 125 for the Nationals. It worked good for you. And you and Bale and Kurdowski really had a battle royale for a long time that summer.
Yeah, well, actually, my prediction when I first got my Suzuki contract was I was not going to do good in the 125 class, but I was going to kick butt in 250. And as it turns out, the 125 factory bike was awesome. It was absolutely on top. It had as much power as Jean-Michel Bale's Honda, and we rode hard together. Some of my best racing in my Nationals was that year against Jean-Michel Bale.
Yeah, and how'd you get along with Bale? A little different dude from
everybody. Well, a lot of I always felt bad for him because whenever he was in his Honda box truck and I'm over there in the Suzuki truck looking at him and trying to talk to him, he would, you know, if I saw him at a restaurant or saw him in the hotel, he would try to talk to me, and he could speak enough broken English that, you know, I don't have the best vocabulary either, so we could talk together, and you know, we got along okay. But what I saw was I'm in the box truck sitting across where I can see him sitting in the back of his box truck, and he's got a translation book. Between motos, he's trying to figure out what to say, and sometimes I'd say, yeah, the cocky little guy's trying to figure out how to say it's nice to be here on the top podium position. But in reality, he was trying to blend in. He was trying, whenever the media would try to talk to him, he tried to speak English. It was, you know, it was his first year over here. And, you know, it was a big bummer to me to see him at a Supercross and the crowd boo him and all that. I know there's a lot of French guys that I don't like, but Jean-Michel Bale was an exception to me. I don't know. I always seemed to really get along with him well. And I invited him to Oklahoma, and after the Dallas Supercross, he came up, and we rode together. And he was big into trials, too, from France. He was actually a trials rider at one time. And so it was fun. We got to play on trials bikes. And then we're playing out at the 500, which I had killer jumps at the 500, big canyon jumps and everything. And he's whipping it completely flat. I'm going, no way. I never see you do a whip out there at Supercross. I go, why don't you do that? Why don't you show the fans? And he looked at me like that's his stuff to go play with. You know, when he's out there racing, you know, that's his job, and he likes to go play. And he was unbelievable about whipping that thing. It was neat to see him get that thing completely flat.
What a contrast in riding styles, him and you, that summer.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. He could hit a line, the same line, every lap, and I was lucky to hit it twice.
And he was always in control and smooth, and there you are, throttle pinned, you know, feet hanging off. And just.
But one of my best races at Hangtown was, you know, that's a fast track. In 1990, it was the fastest I had ever seen Hangtown. And they added that new section in the back, which was wide open. And Jean-Michel Bale and I raced that entire 30 minutes, probably 20 feet apart from each other. And I could take him all the way to the hay bales and just be riding elbow to elbow. The next corner would line up for him to be the inside. He'd come down and push me all the way to the bale. But he never took me into a fence. I never took him off the track. We raced that whole 30 minutes. And for weeks after that, we'd still talk about it because, honestly, we were both stupid. We were 50 miles an hour, inches from taking each other out. Right. It would have been accidental, but, you know, the track's not pavement. And it's real easy to do a swap and accidentally take somebody out.
Yeah, absolutely. So he goes, he's leading the series. He breaks his arm at Washougal. And now you're in the points lead and goes down to the final race. And you and Kudrowski, you guys had a battle, didn't you?
It should have been a cakewalk for me. I had 62 points on Kudrowski whenever Bale broke his arm.
Oh, I didn't know that many,
I had a huge point lead. Bob Hanna, Ron Heben, a lot of the people at Suzuki said, you cannot train the way you do and ride the way you do. You're going to lose this championship because, one, you're going to get hurt out jacking around, playing, and doing the stupid things you do, or you're out of shape and, you know, you're not in as good a shape as Kudrowski, because now they're looking at the next type of rider. So they're not looking at a Bale. They're now looking at a Kudrowski, the methodical, very, very hard dedication to working out. And so they completely try to change the way I'm doing things. So
and you started thinking about it more, and you started thinking about it.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. Then they send me to this doctor, and the doctor's checking my oxygen level and my blood and all this. And so they're handing me, I take like 20 pills a day, and I'm running on a treadmill, and I'm swimming, and I'm riding a road bike. And, you know, it's all this stuff. And I am in way better. There was the 4-week break right after Washougal. That was the summer break, you know. And so I have this big break. I'm completely fit as I've ever been, but driving a car down a lane road, I'm jerking the wheel. I can't keep it nice and fluid down the wheel. I'm looking right in front of the hood, and I jerk to the left, jerk back to the right, jerk to the left. And it's like, what the heck? You know, I'm no longer the same. My thought process isn't the same. My reaction's not the same. And I go to, I think, Binghamton, New York was the next round, and finish a 14th and 18th or something, just dismal. And that point spread starts to lose. The next race out, I get a 7th and 8th, and more points are gone. And we had another week break. And during that week, I said, this stuff is not for me. I said, no way. If I'm going to lose this championship, I'm going to lose it my way.
Like,
and that's when I built the 60-foot canyon jump across the dreaded trees and all that out at the 500. And I was so mad about that I'm not my old self that I put that canyon jump into my moto. That was my every lap I'd do this stupid, can't come up 2 feet short. It was just nothing but trees and a canyon that dropped about 20 feet into the rocks. And so, kind of stupid to be doing that. But at the same time, I had that I'm going to be my old self. And everyone's telling me what I couldn't do. That meant I've got to go do it. So I'm out there just doing all this stuff and came back, started winning. And with four races to go, jump and break the center cases and transmission locks up. So and Kudrowski, I was winning, and now with the cases broke, Kudrowski wins. So I threw 25 points away, and from that four races to go, it went, 1 to 4 points was as far as we ever got away from each other.
Right.
Back and forth.
Yeah, it was quite a battle for sure.
Yeah, nail biter all the way to the end.
What was it like finally winning it though? Here you
are. I rode like crap. Jeff Matasevich and I didn't get along very well in 1990 on the Supercrosses. There were several that I could have been on my way to my first win of a Supercross, and two for sure he took me out on that I had a chance to win. And but at this race at Unadilla, the very last outdoor national. He's running second. I have to finish second to win the championship. I win the first moto. He gets third. The second moto, if he wins, I have to get second, and I win the championship by a point.
Uh-huh.
It's muddy. I go in the first turn, look up. Kudrowski's got the whole shot. I'm about seventh. Don't want to panic, but I'm already tense. I know it's a $100,000 bonus on the line.
Right.
I go into the next turn, fall down.
Uh-huh.
I get back up in 18th or 19th place, and my work's cut out for me. While I was that far back, I didn't have time to think about the money. It's the old charge. You fall down, you get up, you ride harder. And but 3/4 of the way through the race, I've now caught Matasevich. He's in second. I'm in third. I need to pass him.
Yeah.
And I am exhausted. I'm mentally completely way too tight. I'm riding like Bradshaw was in 92.
Yeah.
And in the back, Matasevich slows down, and I go around him, and it's like he gave it to me. He gave me the pass. And I'm riding so bad for about another two laps. He's yelling at me in the corners, wanting me to pick it up. He's going, I'm going to give it to you, but I don't want to just, stand up and ride every corner. And so once I smoothed out, I pulled, 3 or 4 seconds by the finish. But it wasn't it was a gimme. So I do have to, all the Supercrosses I could have won, I guess it's still nice that he gave me one there.
Never heard that story. Look, a chicken.
Jeff Matasevich, it was so funny. I hated his attitude at the in front of people and stuff. He was saying that's what they paid him for and stuff. But Wanda and I would go eat with him, and I'd say, Jeff's got a bad attitude and everything, but one-on-one, he's really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff could turn and yell at a waiter and spill his drink or whatever, and it would be like, yep, that's the Jeff I don't like. Go back to your, be yourself, And so I got along with him good when it was one-on-one. I don't think I necessarily wanted to race against him, but I did like him. I got along with him good when it was just a few of us around.
Was it San Jose he took you out?
Absolutely, yeah. San Jose was that was one of my smartest Supercrosses I ever rode, and it didn't pan out for me. But I was a little bit faster than him, but I know that he's one to retaliate. You go around him, and he'll do everything he can until he gets tired to take you out. And so I followed him and followed him and followed him and followed him, and I could put a wheel on him here, and I go, this, getting towards the end of the race, this might be my better spot to make a pass.
Right.
And then over here, I'd put a little wheel on him and then back out going, okay, this is a good spot that I might be able to pass him. So I had like 3 or 4 spots on the track that when it became the 17th, 18th lap, I could start going, okay, that's where I'm going to try to make my move. And ended up going all the way to 2 laps to go, and so it's like I'm in a panic mode. I need to get around him, and through the whoops, he made a little bobble. The white flag is out for us, and I pass him through the whoops, over the tabletop, 1 lap to go. I followed him for 17 or 18 laps. So now it's time for me to show that I can keep my composure, don't do anything stupid, and I'll win my first Supercross. And I go into the very next left-hand turn, leaving the window open just a little bit, and he comes charging through the inside. Yeah. No way to make the turn, takes us both out.
Yeah.
So a definite bummer. I did slow down because I did that. That was something bad with me, is if I made a pass on somebody, I kind of relaxed because I made my move. You know, I set him up, I made the pass, and now I could relax. Well, bad for me that I took just a little second off my pace there, but also was totally mad about the whole thing because he couldn't have made the turn. You know, I mean, he was going to use me as a berm, and he hit me so hard that it took us both off the track.
No, it's a famous clip. I've seen it a bunch. I'm sure a lot of listeners have seen it, you know, in the highlight shows or whatever. Was that the closest you've ever come, or was there another time that
No, the one that I really should have won was Charlotte in the mud. Jean-Michel Bale is second. I'm in the lead with 3 or 4 second lead, and maybe even more of about a 5 second lead. He was no threat to me. 3 or 4 laps to go, and I go into the turn. It's raining. It's red clay, like I ride in Oklahoma. Slippery as ever. I loved it. I was riding it good.
Right.
And I go into a bowl turn, a nice, easy, long bowl turn, and I hear Larry Myers go, "And Guy Cooper!" And it made me feel so good. I turned my head to listen to him as I was going through the turn, and my front end washed out.
No way.
The dumbest thing in the world. I was spending the money before I finished.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, that was one. And on the podium, I ended up second or third.
Yeah.
And Jean-Michel Bale looked at me and goes, "I wasn't even going to make an effort to catch you. You were riding so good."
Yeah.
And it just, that was almost insult to injury, but that's just the way it is.
You're like, "Oh, what's Larry saying? Oops." So 91, you almost defended your title. You got second again to Gradowski.
Second again, yeah. I think I was 26 points out in 89, but there was two guys in front of me, so I was really not the heated battle. And then in 91, started off the year with a win, had some stuff going good, and, you know, just some things kind of fell apart, this and that. Carrying the number one plate is a lot of weight on your shoulders. You know, I felt like I rode better as the underdog than as the one that carries the number one plate.
Right.
But I wasn't too far off, and the last round, didn't pull any shenanigans. I probably, looking back on it, for another $100,000, I probably should have knocked Kudrowski down because we were neck and neck and riding close. And on Kudrowski's fault, he was probably a fool to ride that close to me because we did hit and fall down at one time, but it was in a slow area. But I remember across after the gravity cavity, and then you switch back and go across. It's pretty fast through those canyons.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was right there next to me trying to make the move back on me. We were back and forth, and, you know, I didn't ride like that. But, it's awful tempting now looking back on it, going, if I race that race today and knowing how hard $100,000 is to make, I probably would have rode a little bit dirtier. But, you know, at the time, I lived what I believed, and I talked about what I believed, and that was I was having fun doing something that I enjoyed doing, and first place didn't mean everything. I rode 100%, and if it was at a Supercross and I finished third, you saw a smile on my face because that was 100% that I put out. I gave everything I had, and I was proud to be on that podium. If I finished seventh, and it was truly 100%, and I rode hard, I was happy with it. You know, I couldn't say I cheated myself. I gave it everything I had, and that happened to be as fast as I could go. And so I live by that. And even today, whenever I talk to people, and, you know, winning isn't everything. I want to instill that in Caitlin, that it's not about the first place. It's how you play the game. And if it's something that's dangerous, like motorcycles, car racing, whatever it may be, especially whenever there's a dangerous factor involved in it, you better be enjoying doing it or don't do it. You know, pick up something else, a golf ball and a club and make sure it's not lightning out and go enjoy it.
You don't strike me as a guy that was necessarily money hungry either, because you sort of stayed with MSR and UFO your whole career. You probably could have made more money with maybe some bigger names, huh?
Yeah, looking back on it, I should have. I had a big offer with Oakley Goggles, and you know, I was true to Beto and stayed with him for a long, long time. And you know, looking back on it, it would have been probably beneficial to bounce around and change. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I also you know, my parents put a lot of had a lot of input on my life by saying, these people are good to you. They're right. Paying you good money. You need to be loyal to them. So that stayed with me through my whole career.
Right. Was 1990 your most financially rewarding year?
Yes, yeah. By far, 1990 was the best.
And then was your contract up the next year, Suzuki? Or was
I only signed one-year contracts every year, 92, 93. You know, for 91, they said that I was getting old, and I remember Ezra Lusk telling me that they were in a meeting, and I'm carrying the number one plate.
Yeah.
And they sign Ezra Lusk for $50,000 more than me and tell Ezra Lusk that I'm an old man and I won't win any more races.
Wow. Hey, thanks, you know, Suzuki. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, that makes you mad. You know, in 92, I'm the winningest rider Suzuki's had in a lot of years.
Yes.
I'm still national number five. You know, better than Mike LaRocco and Larry Ward and everyone who was on the factory Suzuki team at the same time.
Yeah.
And they tell me, oh, you know, you're washed up, you're too old, you're not going to win anything, we don't have a budget for you. So I take a pay cut to stay with them. And then come to find out, they pay Jeff Matasevich, after he got in trouble with Kawasaki, almost $50,000 more than they. It actually was more than $50,000 more than me to sign on Matasevich. And I'm going, no way. You know, it was making me so mad. I was almost. I was actually mad about the whole Suzuki financial thing. But I also can't bite the hand that feeds you. You know, so you just put it under your hat and you keep on going and you do your job like you do. Mm-hmm. And in '92, when I broke my leg real bad, I went into Suzuki in 93 and said, my rod's been in the year, it bothers me, you know, it sticks out into my hip area, and so I can't run, I can't bicycle. I can ride a motorcycle all day long and everything's fine, but if I walk a mile or two, the way that muscle would rub across, it would feel like somebody hit me with a baseball bat at night. So it was really hurting my cross training and getting in better shape. So I told him I was going to get the rods taken out of my leg, and well, both legs, because I had rod from the other one still in there. And it wasn't affecting me. It's just if I'm going to have it done, get them both out.
Right.
And I'll miss 3 months of racing, but I'll be back. If you want me to, I'll take the young kids that are into the Supercross. They can come ride at my track in Oklahoma, which is way better than the crappy track you have up on top of the mountain, you know, back whenever it was in
Hesperia,
yeah, up by there. And I offended them. I made them feel bad that I, you know, I told them they had a bunch of kids that don't train hard, and you know, they're wanting to have their fancy car and go to the lake and drive their boats after their Supercross, and they're not dedicated to racing. And you know, I offended them, but I was telling them what they needed to hear. That it didn't matter that they took offense to it, and they said, we don't want a halftime racer. And so at the end of 93, I really didn't have a Suzuki factory contract. The off-road team, one of the guys was sitting in that meeting, and he came out of the meeting going, that was ballsy, but I think it hurt you on your deal. But if you want to do some off-road riding, we'll put you into, part of the money can come from PR, and we'll pay, you know, part of it. And so, you know, we won't make as much as you did in Supercross, but it's still living. And I said, great, I grew up in the woods. My dad wanted me to ride enduros instead of motocross, so he'll be glad to hear that. So, that, you know, it was an easy transition into the off-road, and I had off-road experience. This thing that was bad about it was I still wanted to Supercross and motocross. And whenever I signed up to run Dallas, actually I signed up to ride Pontiac first in 94, and Suzuki called and said, no, you can't do that. That's Brian Swink's hometown, and we want to make a big media thing, and if you show up, it'll take the limelight away from Brian Swink, and he needs to have that limelight. And so I said, all right. Well, and in the back of my mind, I'm thinking Dallas is my home track. You know, it's my closest Supercross, so, you know, they can't say that about that one. So I sign up for Dallas, and about 3 days before the event, they hear word that I'm signed up to run it. And this is my own motocross bike. You know, I've got factory, or not factory, but bikes that I run the GNCC with. But I'm going to go down there, you know, out of the back of my pickup with some buddies helping me, and we're going to go, you know, race the Supercross. And I'm pumped. I'm feeling good about it.
Right.
And Suzuki says, nope, you do that, and we'll pull all your money and all your contracts. So that was 94, 95. I had in the wording to where they couldn't say that, you know, that it was limited to, you know, off-road. Right. And I put it to, you know, put it in there that it's not limited to any racing and all that stuff. And I was planning on doing the same thing, all excited. And they did the same thing to me. Said, no, it doesn't matter if it's in the contract. They don't want you to ride the Supercross. And so I think part of it was Tosh Koyama. You know, he was about 140 years old. And he's the one who put me in a pasture. He's the one who made the poster that's saying Guy Cooper retiring and, you know, printed the poster in 93 before I had ever in. They never talked to me. They printed the poster before I was done. But
well, in 93, you were a top 10 guy still.
I was a top 10 guy riding an inferior bike. And so looking back on it, it's another reason to be a little bit pissed off at Suzuki. But
Did they send you a championship check in 90 and then, like, a bag of poo at the same time? And say, hey, thanks a lot.
You know, I liked the 125 all, you know, throughout my career racing. That was great. My 90, my 250, not until 96, and that's whenever I'm on the off-road stuff, did I really think that they were on par to do something. And but anyway, that's water under the bridge. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people don't know that there was.
No,
it wasn't. It's not turmoil. I still made money. You got to remember, if you're in California and you're making $40,000 a year, you can't make a house payment.
Mm-hmm.
But in Oklahoma, making $40,000, I'm a king here. I just loved it. You know, I pinch my pennies. I save money, and you know the house and the land. I've got 160 acres that. It's all paid for, and most of that was paid for from my Suzuki days of racing. So I am not at all mad about what I did with Suzuki and the accomplishments I did with Suzuki. That's great. I look back on it going, man, if they only knew my true desire to stay, you know, I bled yellow, you know. I mean, I had done the full transformation from a Honda rider to a Suzuki rider.
Yeah, and you know, it was a different time back then, too, because now LaRocco and Ferry, and they're celebrated, Dowd, they're celebrated for being the old vet guys who are still able to take it to the young kids. And back when you were doing it, it was like, get out of the sport, old man.
It really was. I think they had been burned a little bit. You know, they spent $1 million on Johnny O'Mara when he was truly done on Honda, and they tried to get him to come over to Suzuki and paid him all that money. So I know they had been burned on buying some riders who were past their prime, and they didn't continue. But, you know, I still had it in me to at least want to go do it, you know.
Yeah, I don't think Swink was working out too well either, you know. So.
Yeah, there was Suzuki made a lot of. They spent a lot of money on riders that didn't pan out for them, and you know, it's hard in any sport. You know, at the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm a Raider fan, so I'm loving it right now. But anyways, but even looking back though, you had fans everywhere. You were a crowd favorite. You know, you were jumping guy, Sky Coop, Air Coop, The results were almost secondary to you at a lot of times near the end of your career, and that's invaluable. That's gold, you know?
Well, I did feel that way,
right.
And I tried to, you know, present that to all my sponsors, although, you know, if you go back through and if you knew everybody's paycheck, mine typically was on smaller than everyone else's.
Mm-hmm.
But I was from Oklahoma. I was my own manager. I never hired a manager in, which hindsight, I should have had somebody trustworthy that I could get in there and let them go in there and shake the bushes and see what they could get out of it.
Right.
And, you know, my big saying was, I hate this month. I have to be a businessman. I have to sign my contracts. Then I'm going to go back to being the racer and the guy everybody loves. But right now, I need to ask you for the most money you can give me. You know, what is it? You know, and I wasn't good at negotiations, so, you know, I was kind of my own downfall there, too. But I can look back on it saying I did manage my own money and sign my own contracts and,
You
know.
Paid for a bunch of land and houses and stuff.
And, yeah, I'm happy. You know, overall, I'm walking and talking and 48 years old, and it's been one hell of a ride. And I still get the adrenaline flow out there. I'll go out on my KTM 300 and do something really stupid and laugh about it, going, man, that I remember what that feels like, you know.
Right,
so
right.
I just did that one of those enduro crosses, and that was a lot of fun. I rode the vet class, though, but
yeah,
it was still a lot of fun.
Those are fun to watch, I'll tell you that. I don't know about how fun to ride them, but fun to watch.
I wish that was around 20 years ago. I think it would have really been fun for me.
Yeah. Now, what was up with the comeback on the KTM 540, hole shotting the crap out of Nationals, and generally finishing, you know, just outside the top 10?
I was 11th in the standings before I blew my shoulder up in Millville.
Why'd you do it? How was it? Did you have fun? All that.
I made some promises to some people that whenever I hit 40, I was going to try to come back out and go. And a guy out of Indiana had a KTM with Olin suspension on it, and I rode that bike, and I go, this is the best thing I've ever ridden. I was so pumped with it, but it was set up real soft, and I always liked a bike that was soft. The difference was it was set up as an enduro bike, not set up to hit the motocross jumps hard. So on a local level where there wasn't big jumps and everything or big jarring braking bumps, it was great. But as I needed to take it to the next level, I couldn't. So I hit the ground quite a few times on the thing. But later on in the year, working with Ziggy, using the same suspension that Dowd had, my bike handled really good. And a couple of things fell through. The guy in Indiana kind of ran out of some money and ended up right before the National started. We had big expectations and kind of all fell apart, but I had already committed to doing it, so I went out and paid my own way to go do it with the help of Extreme. Lane Smith with Extreme heard that I was going to do it, and he was a state away and came through with a big help in financial backing, and we went, and it worked out really well until I got a little too cocky. I won the four-stroke national at Colorado before Millville, and so I went into Millville thinking, oh, for sure top 10, although the track never suited me that well. Out of all the nationals, I've won at 12 different tracks, and that track was one that never, it always eluded me, and it was a tough one for me. And this one, on this day, John Dowd flew off one of those downhill with a jump at the top, and I had been breaking over the it's kind of like a peak jump, and then you went racing down the hill. Well, he launched off of it. I go, oh, that's what he's doing. He's clearing that, so he's landing on the downhill. So the next lap around, I hit the thing at Mach 1 and flew down the hill. I landed in a big hole, and it just popped me over the bars. It was stupid. It was practice, and I should have been. I just went way over my head.
Yeah. Funny that you're pacing yourself off Dowd. You guys are there in 2000, and I don't even know what year that was.
2002.
Okay. Yeah, you're 02, and you're looking at Dowd going, hey, 10 years ago, wasn't this line the good one? Oh, that's funny. Well, any regrets in your career? Not winning a Supercross, I guess? Is that?
It wasn't without the lack of trying, so I can't be mad about that. I've got some neat trophies. I've met a lot of neat people all over the world. Racing's been awesome. That's the bottom line. It's been awesome.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Yeah, it's good to hear, you know. Well, right on, man. Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it. It's always been a guy I wanted to catch up with and see what was going on, and I'm sure your fans will listen to this and know all about it. So
All right.
Learned
well,
some cool things.
It was nice talking with you, and I'm sure we left a lot of unanswered questions out there, but we can do it again sometime.
Yeah, for sure. Let's try to do a part two. All right, Cooper, thanks very much for doing the BTOsports.com Transworld Motocross podcast. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This has been the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Transworld Motocross. Don't forget to check out some of our past shows, including motocross legends such as
The Beast from the East, Damon Bradshaw.
It got to the point where I didn't want to leave home, and once I got to the race, I wasn't into it. If I wasn't going to give 100%, I'm not going to take their money.
The working class hero, Doug Henry.
It was definitely an emotional moment for me, just thinking to myself, that's it, you know, and it's amazing the stuff that goes through your head in a short amount of time of the things that, you know, that I was going to miss.
The daughter, Ron Machine.
Until you really open your ears and you want to listen to what they're saying, it's like beating a dead horse. I mean, you know, and I know from personal experience, did anybody ever sit me down? Of course they did. Everybody did.
Go Circuits, Mitch Payton.
There's two ways to make the money. One is you can sign for money, or two, you can earn the money. I'm a high believer in earning the money. I think they ride better when they earn the money.
Seven-time Jeremy McGrath.
I was so mad, like so disappointed and so frustrated that I pulled the pick and I left. Every point counts. I could kick myself to this day for not just riding around in tents. It's been no problem. My ego got in the way, you know?
The O Show, Johnny O'Mara.
Stuff that you'd sit there if you didn't even want to ride it, you just wanted to just look at it all day. I mean, I got a chance to test all that. I like that era I was in. I really do.
Search Mathis on the iTunes Store to find these and many more great podcasts. I won't let this die.